Welcome. Thanks for being here on this gorgeous afternoon. End of a very good and very long week for me, for many of you, I'm sure, as well. But let me stick around as well. My name is Jason, for those I haven't met yet. Leading a series this week called Becoming a Christian in Christendom. It's a very loosely knit title for a lot of different issues that I find important in Christian theology today, all of which I think have to do with maintaining Christian distinctiveness or particularity or even peculiarity in a culture that sometimes subsumes Christianity into just the dominant culture, where being Christian means nothing more and nothing less than being nice or normal or good, maybe upper middle class, whatever we associate. But certainly Christianity means more and less than that. And that it's in Christians' self-interest, I think, good self-interest, to maintain our identity and to know what it means and try to really hold on to that. Our last session here, this Friday, is called Becoming a Christian in a Culture of War. And I saved it for today because I'm bound to make people mad by reading this conversation. So all I have is another, 20 hours after this? Sign up for extra dish team duties or something and then slip away quietly before, you know, I'm driven out of Fulton Village. No, I do think on almost every theological issue, you can kind of predict liberal versus conservative camps and how people see things differently. When it comes to war, I think those normal kind of poles get really crazily messed up. That some people who are against war in Christian names, in the name of Christianity, look nothing like liberals. In fact, they're very critical of liberalism. Many of these folks come out of the Radical Reformation. They're Anabaptists, Mennonites, Amish, folks like this. And they're deeply conservative, theologically in some ways, but part of what they want to conserve theologically is Jesus' way of nonviolent love, and understand that to be something that they're called to do, not just in their personal life or not just in their inner intentions, but something that we do in the world, that being a Christian calls you apart or sets you apart from culture, especially when the culture is engaged in war. We know, living in this country, that our country is often engaged in war. Some would say it's always engaged in war. There's relative peace at times, but we have a standing military. We're always ready to go to war. We work on the assumption that war is a threat at all times, at least the last couple hundred years. And some would say Christianity just offers a radically different path. So I want to explore some of this. I do so as a Lutheran. Lutherans, as you know, kind of in a middle stage historically. There's people like the Radical Reformers who are more consistently and more vehemently anti-war in all cases. They're called pacifists, right? And there's other folks who more believe in a holy war tradition, that you can use the name of God and go to war fighting under the cross in God's name. Lutherans and other magisterial reformers, or mainline churches, are usually pitched in the middle of those two camps. They're not against war in principle always. They make exceptions. They think of scenarios where you should go to war. Tragically, you should go to war. But on the other hand, too, they're very nervous about ever using God's name to endorse or justify a war. They're kind of pitched in the middle. So we'll explore a little bit of that middle space. The just war tradition comes out of that. But I, as one of these people who are raised in this mainline church in the middle, am very challenged by folks speaking from this pacifist tradition. In many ways, I wish I could stand in front of you and say I'm a Christian pacifist. But I know that I haven't done the hard work that it takes to become a pacifist. Pacifism isn't just that I've never killed anyone in warfare, right? I've done that by lack of opportunity. I haven't had to do anything to not be put in that situation. So I'm not a pacifist. I can't call myself a pacifist just because I haven't gone to war, or in some theoretical sense I don't believe in war. Pacifists really work hard to cultivate a set of dispositions that lead to certain Christian virtues that make engagement in war unthinkable. And I'm just really aware that that takes a lot of ongoing, sustained work. And I'm really intrigued by that way of life, and I hope that I move closer and closer to it. But I don't pretend to be there. There are folks I know who are there, and part of what I'll do is share some of their stories as well. Okay? Let me begin by reading the hard sayings from Matthew's Sermon on the Mount. Bible study this week. Pastor Stacy has been leading us through the Beatitudes. This is included in that same sermon, and they're often called the hard sayings, and I think most of us can figure out why. This helps set up a certain historical framework I'll give us for thinking about Christianity and warfare in just a minute here. Beginning with verse 38 of chapter 5, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. You have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." That's concluding with verse 48. Hard sayings, right? We know why. These are hard, especially that last one, right? Be perfect. Luther, along with many other reformers, will take that to be a kind of word of the law in most cases. That what a verse like that does is really drives us to embrace grace. It points out how far we are from the Christian goal, from the kind of glory and justice that God deserves, to be perfect, to be God's children at every waking moment. And then what a verse like that does is meant to reveal our sinfulness. I'm not perfect. You may be, but I doubt it. But I know I'm not perfect. And that a verse like that is supposed to make me realize it, so that I can hang on to the grace of God, that I desperately cling to that because I know I'm hopeless without it, right? There's others, these radical reformers, who are going to also understand the verse that way, but they're also going to say, that's not the first word. The first thing a verse like that does, or all these verses do, is not just show us our sinfulness, but actually name a Christian ideal. This is a way of life. Turn the other cheek, pray for those who persecute you, love your enemies. This is what Christians are called to do. Certainly we need to resort to grace. We're not always going to do it. I don't know anyone, including my Anabaptist friends, who say, yeah, I've arrived, I'm perfect, right? But before we rely on grace, we strive. We strive. We say that this is really the vision that Christ calls us to enact, and we go for it. We try it. And we can't put grace first. Grace is second in some ways. We resort to grace after we hear the law and after we strive to do it. That's a very different piety, I think, than many of us know, including myself. But I always want to hear it. I always want to have these friends keeping me honest in some ways and say, right, how soon do you know that you can't do it? And you say, well, God will take care of it. I certainly can't. How soon does that word of grace come in? It's a really good question, one that's powerful for me. Let me pause here and just hear initial impressions about these hard sayings, this conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount before I do a little bit more historically by the way that this verse has been interpreted. And then we'll get more into both pacifist communities and just work. Responses that you have?
You said you couldn't be a pacifist because you couldn't do the hard work.
If you're an older
woman and you don't have to go to war anyhow, can you just be a lazy pacifist?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that a moral stance anyhow?
Yeah.
You're lazy?
say
it's wrong.
Right, right. No, I think that's probably where I am. I think it's better than some options. What I mean to say is I take very seriously what Pastor Stacy said this morning in the Bible study when it said, blessed are the peacemakers, that making peace is not a passive stance, right? It's not the lack of war. Peace is envisioned in the New Testament. Every Bible verse mentions, every chapter of the New Testament, not every chapter, excuse me, every book of the New Testament mentions shalom, peace. But that's not just the absence of war. So if we find ourselves outside of war, that we're somehow pacifists. The way I've lived my life, I've never had to develop the dispositions or the virtues that would counter warfare or that would bring about peace in a really active way. Now, hopefully I've done that in small ways.
Yeah, you have children.
Yeah. I laugh.
Yeah.
You are a peacemaker.
What's
a you are a peacemaker.
Or on my way. I just want to accept this really humble. I think it's easy for some Christians to, you know, I have a sign in the guest room of our house that's peace in different languages, and certainly we believe in peace. But I want to give a lot of credit to people who have put their money where their mouth is, who have not just talked the talk but walked the walk, that they've done a lot more to try to develop these dispositions of peacefulness than I am. Yeah, hopefully I'm on the way. You too? Lazy pacifist?
Yeah.
We can talk more about that. Yeah, please.
It's a question that I've been asked by my son on occasion, who's not. Would you have fought in the Vietnam War? Now, I was born in 1954, so I was 18 in the last year of the Nixon lottery, and I was drawn 105th, and they only drafted as far down as 2 that year because the war was starting to wind down, at least the draft was. And I had written a letter to my draft board, I was 18 at the time, saying that I didn't agree with the war and that they needn't count on me if they ever called me, but that I was writing a letter to register and comply with the law. But I have, from that day until this, refused to say what I would have done if I had in fact been drafted. Would I have gone to Canada? Would I have gone to prison? What I've reported for duty, because talk is cheap. And I feel that in saying what I would have done or what I think I might have done, that I disrespect those, many of whom I knew and know, who actually had to make the choice. So I did not answer Mark's question, and I have resolved never to answer that question for that very reason.
And blessed are you because you don't have to.
Indeed. Yeah. Fortunately, yeah. And myself as well.
Although if we had a draft, people might be thinking a little more seriously about the necessity.
Mm-hmm. And I think peacefulness, the virtues of peacefulness, certainly go beyond not going to war, although that's a moment of truth, right?
Yeah, I would venture to say that doing nothing can also be a violent act.
Yeah, right.
And so just kind of broadening our idea of what violence is. It's not just shooting a gun. It's not just striking someone else. Violence can exist in many ways. Violence can exist internally, too.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks. Any other initial impressions or hard sayings? I've prepared a lot less today than I have in the last 4 sessions because we've been kind of brimming with comments and perspectives that have just been rich and wonderful. So. I'm not going to do as much by way of orienting our conversation today, so hopefully I'll do a little bit, we'll get the conversation going, and then I might step back in and give a little more context if it's helpful for folks. Some of this will be very old hat for many of you. Let me give a quick Christian history, starting at a place where most of us know. We think that Jesus was born in about 3 before the Common Era. BCE and CE is just a more inclusive way, right, to say BC and AD. Probably around 3. These dates are disputed. If that's about right, he probably lived to be about 30. I don't mean that he's not still living. Before he died. Right, of the Common Era. Real big event, 3 days later, right there, gets up, okay. Destruction of the temple is in 70 of the Common Era. Earliest Christians think of themselves as Jews. When Paul's writing, he's also including the Gentiles. Big discussion about whether you need to be Jewish first. Those books are written maybe as early as the 40s into the 50s. First Gospels are a little bit before or right after the destruction of the temple. Probably Mark first, probably Matthew and Luke next. John is maybe as late as about 100 of the Common Era. The first three Gospels are considered the synoptics because we can view them together. They share a lot of the stories, and we think that they read one another, at least Matthew and Luke, having Mark in front of them, as well as some other source because they share other stories. This is the hypothesis, and we just call that Q now. We don't know anything about it. For the first few hundred years, and you'll get different versions of this story for sure, and some of you may want to tweak it. The first few hundred years, Christianity is a minority religion in the Roman Empire. It's tolerated from its inception to a certain degree, although there's moments where there's pretty virulent persecution against Christians, along with Jews, too. This is a big event for changing the dynamic between Rome and the Jewish people. There's an uprising a few years before, 66 or 67, a Jewish revolt. So Christianity is in a very precarious, tenuous position. It's a minority religion. In some ways, it latches on to Judaism or stays with its Jewish roots because Judaism is given certain privileges by Rome, and they want to latch on to that. But the more and more that Rome conflicts with the Jewish religion, the more that Christianity distinguishes itself from Judaism and becomes its own thing. It's a persecuted religion, and Christians, by and large, up until the early 4th century, are pacifists by default. Now, this is where it gets disputed. Some will say that's too broad of a statement, and it's certainly a generalization. But there's a lot of literature that we know from this time where early Christians are debating what a Christian should do if he, in those days he, wants to be a Roman soldier, wants to get citizenship from Rome and become a soldier, or whether Rome wants to have him as a soldier. And it's a very big discussion. Now, even if we say that people land on different sides, we know that because it's such a big debate, Christians are very nervous about their Christian identity, what would happen to their Christian identity if called to war. It's assumed that Christians don't go to war. Romans go to war, and Christians are called to a different life. And this is the life that they're called to. The hard sayings from the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plains. This is a kind of Christian ethos, and it's a time of many Christian martyrs. We know a lot of them from reading the book of Acts and other New Testament texts, where Christians go to their death rather than to fight in some cases. If they have to choose between giving allegiance to Caesar, Caesar would be called Lord during this time, or giving their allegiance to Jesus, they give their allegiance to Jesus, and many are persecuted for that. If drafted into the Roman army, drafted, scare quotes, they say, no, I'm a Christian, I can't do it, okay? Around 311, there's a kind of sea change. Now, it's not as pivotal as that. It doesn't happen all of a sudden. It's a kind of gradual process. But something big does happen here with the conversion of Constantine. Constantine is a Roman emperor who has a vision before he goes into a really big and important battle. Has this vision, according to legend, that under this sign you will conquer. And he sees a sign of the cross. The cross is just becoming a symbol for Christianity. What a weird symbol, right? We need to remind ourselves of this. Jesus, can you imagine a little electric chair, right, that we all are wearing around our necks? That's essentially what it is. What's that?
How about a syringe?
Or a syringe, right. Lethal injection or electric. I mean, essentially that's, right, so it takes a while for it to begin to be a symbol, but it's starting to be a symbol. And Constantine sees the symbol of the cross and hears the voice, under this sign you will conquer. And lo and behold, he kicks the living poop, I'd say to my kids, out of the other army, and he decides there's something to this Christianity stuff. It's powerful stuff. And he converts to Christianity. It's the first upper echelon Roman government official that converts. And when the emperor converts, guess what? It's going to take all his peeps along with them. Not overnight, but gradually, around the beginning of the 4th century, Christianity goes from being a minority, persecuted religion under Roman rule, right, to being the official religion of the now Holy Roman Empire. That's where we get that word. Right now it's a wedding of church and state, and the Roman Empire has the blessings of Christianity, and more importantly, Christianity has the protection and the blessings of Rome. There's a kind of combination here, the political state, right, with its own understanding of what peace entails, Pax Romana, a peace by way of sword, and Christianity. This introduces a huge problem, right? Now the problem goes from what does a Christian do if he is called into war? And the most common answer is refuse to go, even if it means martyrdom, to what do you do now that you have soldiers who are being baptized and mass altogether, right? Now all these soldiers are Christian, automatic. I mean, by name at least, not because they're living this out, but they're baptized in droves, right? Now it's the official religion, and you're Christian unless you work really hard not to be Christian. Here's the beginning of Jewish-Christian armed conflict, right, where Jews will die by Christians under the sign of the cross, and that happens for a long, long time, as we know. What a sea change. What a sea change. Let me pause here. Here, some nuance. Certainly some of you are going to want to tweak this story that I'm telling in some ways, or responses, reactions to this. You can see how we're setting up the kind of problems that we have with warfare in a Christian tradition. And I don't mean to be heavy-handed, but... yeah, please.
To what extent was martyrdom or refusal to give allegiance to Caesar, to what extent was that because of a refusal to fight or to go to war? Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, many people would refuse to give allegiance to Caesar without war as an issue, many women.
Yeah.
But I was fascinated. I was just fascinated because I just hadn't thought before that maybe refusing to give allegiance to Caesar had to do with refusing to be a soldier.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you had any idea to what extent that was the case.
I don't. Others would be able to answer much more historically accurate than I can. I think, you know, unlike today where we have a voluntary military, at least since Vietnam, right? I mean, anyone can be a soldier. Anyone can be commanded to be a soldier, right, by Rome. So the test case for your loyalty to Caesar and your willingness to fight, I think, practically would often go hand in hand, or could go hand in hand at any moment, right? That would be the ultimate fidelity is fighting in the Roman army. Usually, those are Roman citizens. So sometimes Christians don't have to decide. They're not Roman citizens. They're not asked to fight. And they need a number of years working under those conditions to develop these kind of dispositions that think of themselves as, yeah, we don't fight. We're Christian. We're not a Roman soldier, a Roman citizen. But Rome would often ask others to fight on their behalf or otherwise pay homage to Caesar. And that's where Christian fidelity was called into account. They had to decide. And that's why they were martyred as well. Yeah, sorry, others know much more. Yeah. Other comments? Yeah.
So when does the Roman Empire start to say that we are actually fighting these wars for the purpose of conversion, whether that's their actual reason or not?
Right.
I mean, the reason you're going to war makes a difference, at least for some people.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the Crusades are the most obvious example of that. Most of the warfare here is with the barbarians, these Germanic peoples coming down. Later it will be with Islam and other, you know, Inquisition and other things. Again, I can't give a good answer as I should.
Constantine used the church as justification for warfare.
For warfare, yeah, that we're clear about.
Mm-hmm. So
whether or not warfare had the right away had the desired purpose of conversion rather than subduing the enemy, right?
Or resources.
Yeah, resources. That's probably a little more gradual. And went hand in hand, too. Yeah.
Historically, the Crusades came later.
Yeah, much later.
So they put crosses on the shields rather quickly.
Yeah, and the first sign was just the inverted sword, right? How convenient. You go into battle with your hand on the blade under the sign of the cross, and then when the time is right, flip it around. It's a powerful image, isn't it? Yeah.
I think one of the nuances for me during the Constantine period was all the Christians who had refused at that point, up to that point, and how do you get them to convert? Not so much the soldiers who are already fighting,
right,
but the others. And
right,
what I have learned is that Constantine approached the bishops, offered them private property, and some very good financial packages in order to convince the prisoners now to change their attitude,
yeah,
by war.
Yeah. And again, many of us know, we can pool our resources in terms of the details of that as well. I'm sure that that's a big part of it. Also, just think of the relief. I mean, you would die under these Roman soldiers. I mean, they were the threat. Now you're on their team all of a sudden, right? I mean, your religion is the official religion. You can read, a textbook about Constantine that is this, thinks of this as the moment that the church survives, right? Here it's a fledgling cult that we don't know, and here it has real power in the world for the first time. This is when Christianity takes off, and it spreads according to the way that the Holy Roman Empire spread, through conversion, sometimes by sword, sometimes peacefully, right? So even without the extra incentives that I'm sure were there, Christianity is going to live. I'm going to live as a Christian. We can be sure of it, right? I'm on the winning team all of a sudden. But the hard question then is at what expense, right? Do we become fundamentally a different religion? Does discipleship, Christian discipleship, mean something extraordinarily different? This is where the pacifist church, these Anabaptists, will say, this is the point where Christianity goes awry. This is the fall of Christianity. Unlike the magisterial reformers, by magisterial reformers, I mean those reformers like Luther, like Calvin, who work under the auspices and the protection of princes in the area. For Luther, it was in Germany. They have princes. There's a whole, political feud going on between different feudal lords and princes who are over areas, and then the Catholic Church that has its own kind of hands in different areas. The princes have a lot of stake in the Reformation because they want local autonomy away from Rome. And there's a deal that gets brokered between the reformers and the princes. You protect me. I mean, Luther was under death threat for most of his life. You protect me, and we won't cross you. There's a new kind of agreement between political power, the princes under the sword, and the Reformation. The magisterial reformers always were coupled, almost always were coupled with political power, the protection. The radical reformers said, we don't want to reform the church. We don't think that the last 1,200 years, we're talking about 1600s here, we don't think that the last 1,200 years have been good and something that needs reforming. We want to return to the original church. We want to return to the primitive church. They didn't understand themselves as a purification of Christian history, 1,500 years of Christian history, but as a return to this early Christian time where pacifism and this kind of radical discipleship was more of the norm, right? And they were persecuted both by Rome and by the magisterial reformers. Luther and other reformers had no place for these radical reformers. And I'm generalizing a lot. I mean, there's a lot of different radical reformers. Some are militant. Some want to bring about a revolution by sword. Others are militantly pacifist, right? They're radically pacifist. But none of them have the protection of princes.
Yeah, maybe you can talk a little bit more about how the radical reformers get pacifism out of the text, just out of the gospel text or out of the New Testament in general. I don't think it's entirely straightforward, and at least the evidence that you've been giving us about the early church, especially under Roman rule, it also doesn't seem entirely clear that that was the consensus, both because of what Cindy was saying about the connection between, or just all of the things that allegiance to Caesar means. Like, it means war, but it also means so many other things.
Right.
It seems
right.
Like you could be against that for many different reasons. Also, texts that I'm familiar with, early martyrologies, that are very martial in their imagery. And imagine the martyrs, in fact, doing violence to their Roman oppressors. So if you, yeah. maybe you can just talk about how they, how the radical reformers get there.
Right, right. That's great. And that's all the nuance that gets covered over in this. I'm telling the story here how my Anabaptist friends tell it, because I think it's the story that I most need to hear. You could tell the story, again, where this is a really good thing, a good event, and with a lot of nuance about what happens, all the different ways of being a Christian. But to answer your primary question more straightforwardly, certainly the hard sayings they take as a key to the New Testament, a hermeneutical key. We used that language earlier. So that kind of lens through which they interpret the whole of the New Testament. They also take the New Testament as radically more important than the Hebrew Bible, right? And they really think that the New Testament is the full disclosure of God and God's will and what Christian discipleship means, and that these hard sayings. And then the life. There's a lot less about atonement. There's a lot less discussion about what atonement means, what Jesus' death and resurrection does for Christians, and much more about the pattern of Jesus' life. What does Jesus' own life exhibit about Christian discipleship? So you'll hear this word discipleship again and again in pacifist and Anabaptist quarters. It's not about, first of all, about grace or what Jesus does for me. It's about a way of life that is exhibited by this man that we then follow after, right? And it's radically kenotic. This here, actually, Luther gets really close, I think, because he too thinks of Jesus' life as radically kenotic. Kenosis means a kind of self-giving or a self-sacrifice. And the easiest way to describe that is they understand Jesus as one who in every case would rather suffer and die than kill, who always meets power with self-giving love to the point of being crucified. And that it's Rome that crucifies him. They're very clear. It's the political powers. Jews play a part in that, but that role is secondary. Jesus is one who does not fight with or against Rome, but radically submits to witness to a different way of life. I know that that's not a full answer. That's the best I can do now, and certainly keep us coming back to it.
As a young man, I was told that the passage in the New Testament where Jesus meets the centurion was evidence that Christianity was not an anti-military or pacifist religion, the theory being that he didn't tell the centurion to quit the Roman army and turn in his sword as he did the young man. He told him to give away all his possessions to the poor. And that since he let the centurion go back to duty, presumably he was not at least adamantly opposed to all things military. What do you think of that argument?
It's hard. As we mentioned in the discussion about Judaism, I understand the Gospels to be written under Roman rule. I mean, certainly, historically, they are. And I think that Christians do well to read them as such, right? So what we have is kind of underground protest literature in these Gospels, right? And you don't say Caesar sucks in underground protest literature. Right. In many ways, people who are oppressed more easily turn against other people who are oppressed. Right. Think of Bosnia, a number of places around the world. Right. And that's more of the glimpse we get. Right. So if we don't have overt anti-Caesar or anti-Roman language in the Gospels, for me, historically, that makes a lot of sense. Where I don't know if we could use that example, what we don't hear about Rome in the Gospels, to be evidence that there's some, you know, condoning of a military or something like that. I mean, just the passion narrative is Jesus, I think, utter nonviolent love, right? And you know, put away the sword. And those are, again, that the pacifist churches are going to latch onto and say, that's a way of life and we ought not leave it. Let's talk a little bit about what happens here. And then I can literally and metaphorically sit down. We'll keep talking. The just war tradition evolves quickly. Just war tradition actually predates Christianity. It goes back to some Stoic literature. Just war is this middle ground between pacifism on one hand that says Christians are called to a way of life that is incompatible with warfare. Right? let me just say a little bit more about that. They're not saying war is morally wrong, or that they're not working on a principle that says you ought not go to war. We tend to think about ethics and ethical choices as working on these kind of principles, right? They actually aren't making principles. It's not a rule-based ethic. It's a practice. They think that the way of life that Christians are called to lead will make war unthinkable, right? A way to put that is, when we are doing things like turning our other cheek and praying for those who persecute us, we'll make shitty soldiers. Excuse me, I'm not sure. We'll make really, really bad soldiers, right? We'll be getting kicked out of the army left and right, right? Because our way of life is incompatible with warfare. You just can't go to war and do these things. You make for bad soldiers, right? So it's not on principle, but it's on practice. And the pacifists that I know make a really big deal of that distinction. It's not saying war is always wrong. It's saying we're called to a way of life that makes war unthinkable. And that's different. So you have pacifism on this side. You have holy war on the other side, which is, you know, like the Crusades, fighting under the sign of the cross. We believe God is calling us to conquer these people or to defend ourselves or whatever else. You invoking God's name for warfare. This middle position that evolves throughout the Middle Ages, through the Reformation, that we hear a lot in our churches, is called the just war tradition. Let me talk about it in two ways. First of all, a kind of series of distinctions that Christians need to make to say that we believe that this is the word of God, and yet we still believe that war is necessary in some circumstances. Early on, we have a distinction by someone like Augustine. He makes this between inner disposition and outer action. We can think about dividing ourselves that way, what goes on inside of us in terms of our mentality or our pieties, and then what we actually do, and say that these hard sayings are meant to dictate this. We ought not hate, we ought to love, but they don't dictate this. Right? So Augustine thought you could lovingly put another person to death. And you should. You're unchristian if you have blood on your hands because you hate the person. But if you love the person, right? And he even thought in a Donatist controversy that Christians could be physically reprimanded, sometimes killed for being unorthodox. But that had to be loving. That had to be a way of saving their souls. Augustine thought, sometimes it's worse to let someone work out their own damnation, let them live, than it is to kill them. The more loving act would be killing. And that what these hard sayings dictate is our dispositions, the reason why we do these things, right? It's a way of saying we take this 100% seriously, but it doesn't apply to anything and everything. It applies to one zone. Yeah, please.
Is that what Bonhoeffer was getting at when he
was a pacifist and yet was in a plot to
assassin
Hitler? $1 million question, yeah. He's read very, very differently. Lutherans sometimes read him as this is a kind of sin boldly, and he thought it was a sin, but a kind of necessary sin. Bonhoeffer was always, from what I know of him, always weary of deciding why this was right. I mean, he always did that in fear and trembling, right? And not ever confident that he knows the will of God, and this is it, right? To be in an assassination plot to kill Hitler. So I don't know. You know as well as I. But something like this could happen. Another real common one. Go ahead.
Didn't Bonhoeffer also, his last word before the execution, express extreme regret for even being a part of the plot?
I don't know that part of Bonhoeffer.
I do expect that there are ways that isn't as hypocritical as it first appears.
Sure, sure. I mean, I yell at my kids all the time and say, this is the way they'll grow up. not all the time, I hope. No, but we do a lot of things that look harsh, but out of loving dispositions, or at least we believe that can be true, right?
No?
By
their fruits, you shall know them.
I just saw who was saying it. You were the one who was shaking your head when I did this. Yeah.
Well, I learned that for the first time today, so yeah. Thank you.
But this is a very common way to think about it, right? We can think about some, if not dichotomy or contradiction, tension between what our actions look like we're doing, plot to kill Hitler, and the motives that are behind them. Right? Another real common one that Protestants don't think about are general precepts and counsels of perfection or counsels for perfection. This, in the Roman Catholic Church, for most of Christian history, is a very common division, that these hard sayings are offered for people who decide to lead a perfect life, for those who are striving to be saints. These are priests and monks and nuns, and they apply only for them. Laity have to do dirty work, like join armies and do other things, right? And so there's general precepts that all Christians should follow, and some Christians are called to a higher task. So a priest or a monk would never join the army throughout Christian history. The movie The Mission that we watched a clip in earlier deals a lot with this, right? Whether a person of the cloth should ever fight. But it's a distinction that makes a lot of sense. It says, yes, this is entirely true, but only for some people, some Christians. Now, Protestants don't like that much. One thing that Reformation did is say, depends on which one you cross out. Priesthood of all believers, we're all in the same boat. If this is a commandment, it's a commandment for all of us, and we've got to work with it as such. But it might be a commandment that is a second use of the law, pushing us to God's grace, not actually actualizable. One of the distinctions Luther makes is between love of self and love of neighbor. Here it gets really tricky, right? Okay, I'm called to turn the other cheek when someone is attacking me. Luther thought you don't have a right to defend yourself. But attack my neighbor, right? And now not acting, to return to some of earlier language, not acting to intervene violently if necessary is unloving. It's not protecting the neighbor, right? And anytime you dispute with somebody or if a pacifist disputes with someone, they mention Pearl Harbor, you know, not acting sounds incredibly unloving. To people who this makes sense to, and I'm one of them, right? Maybe I'm called to radical nonviolence when it comes to my own self-protection, but I'm not called to that when my neighbor's health or life is at stake. It makes some sense, right? This applies to me, not to the way I should intervene if my neighbor's under attack.
You could also push that. Allowing somebody to kill me is not so good for their soul either.
Yeah. Augustine thought that too, actually. It's great, right? In some places, Augustine comes close to saying it's better I kill you than you kill me, right? Because I know the state of my soul and know why I'm doing it, but I don't know the state of your soul. So if you kill me, you might be reaping your damnation. I might be saving you by killing you. But if you kill me, I might be damning you. I might be allowing you to damn you. He comes really close to that, right? These things can play out in really weird kind of ways. But this is a common one, and I think a really powerful one.
Just a quick question on that, the sort of self-neighbor distinction. Because, of course, you know, if you allowed yourself to be hurt, that would be to the great harm of your children and your family, right? I mean, it works both ways.
Right.
I'm just sort of wondering whether the Anabaptists and other pacifists that you know make any sort of distinction between pacifism as it applies to the self versus pacifism to defending others, or whether there are different doctrines of pacifism around that.
There certainly are a lot of different ways to be pacifist. The pacifists I know, some that are involved in the Mennonite Church, will be very suspicious that once these kinds of distinctions are introduced, including this one, that it's a kind of license to do what we would do normally, and I can always say, you know, it's out of love for the neighbor or whatever. And I've pressed some of them. Stanley Hauerwas is a very popular theologian who teaches at Duke. I taught there for a few years and got to know him fairly well. I mean, the hardest question you pose to someone like him is, yeah, someone's attacking your kids. What do you do? And he says that it's, as a Christian, I can't save them from their martyrdom. And it's un-Christian to violently save someone else in that way. And as hard as that sounds, right? But he'll also say, you know, I don't know what I do, right? You know,
self-defense doesn't require killing of other people.
Right, right. And many pacifists are going to say there's a big distinction between violence and lethal violence, or you know, and you can be actively nonviolent. Many pacifists believe in police and protection, all this stuff. It's just when it comes to warfare where the possibility of killing is always there, right? Real bullets and real guns, and then you're at a different level. So pacifism doesn't mean passivity in any means, but usually nonviolence means no lethal violence or no possibility of lethal violence.
Is a blockade a loving way of a blockade that causes starvation, a loving way to fight?
Yes, because it gives an opportunity for change.
Yeah. Some would say that the nonviolent movement in the 60s, you know, is very active nonviolence, right? And it can be productive in bringing about change, right? Of sit-ins and protests that reveal to the oppressor his or her violence, right? And make a spectacle of it, get it on TV, and then change happens. Yeah.
And then the result of that is that, you know, with some of the Anabaptists that you're talking about, the result is withdrawal from society versus where, when you're talking about the 60s, these people were not withdrawing from society. They were actively engaging in a change in their society.
Right. Another big charge, right, is that these churches that come out of the Radical Reformation and people who call themselves pacifists, are sectarians. They don't believe in the universal church. And what they're doing is they're thinking about Christianity as a real small, tight-knit group, and that they're irresponsible for the needs of others, right? So Germany attacks Poland. That's not my concern, right? My concern is with this group. The charge of sectarianism is a really hard one to answer. There's been a lot of disputes of this. But you do see a kind of fundamental different piety in this. These are both pretty negative words. A more positive one would be that these folks are more interested in preserving Christian identity than they are in preserving Christian relevance. One thing that happens with Constantine is that the question, according to pacifists, according to these Anabaptists, one of the things that happens with Constantine is the question goes from, what should a Christian do, right? Live out this way. What does it mean to be a Christian? Well, let's talk about Jesus' life and let's live this out. To what kind of action can be universalizable, right? Because Constantine, Rome is the world. It's the civilized world, right? And so we should ask nothing of Christians, no more and no less than we should ask of everything, everyone. So what is right for Christians is what is right for all. We're trying to be relevant to the whole world, right? And so you have the question raised, well, what if nobody intervened, right? Well, we don't like that would look like. Hitler would run all over Europe. Where Christian questions is not what everyone should do, but what are we called to do? Yeah, soldiers might be called to intervene. That's not our question. Question is what we're called to do, and then whether we can live that life, whether that life is compatible with another life style. Is there more compatibility with being a Christian and being a patriot than there is being Christian and being Muslim or Jewish? Sorry, I'm asking a bad question.
Yeah.
Let me put it this way. It's interesting to think about why we don't have a lot of problem, most of us, thinking that I'm patriotic and I'm pro-America and I'm Christian and those identities are perfectly compatible. Then, it would be really goofy if I say I'm Christian and I'm Hindu, for most of us. Not as goofy for the Hindus, actually, but for some Christians that'd be really goofy, right? Christianity, the borders of Christianity are guarded according to other beliefs, other religions, but not other practices, one of which might be the practice of war. The radical reformers are going to say that you can't be pro-American in a time of war and be Christian. Those are very different practices. And you have to choose, like the early Christians do. Is Caesar Lord? or is Jesus Lord? Again, I'm not saying I believe this because I haven't lived it, but I hear the power of it.
What if you happen to think of yourself as a citizen of the world? Then you really fit nowhere and everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. And that's another, I think that's another version of pacifism, is a kind of global, sometimes humanistic, right? A deeply humanistic principle. I think Christian pacifists sometimes are of that vein, and we get some of that I'm forgetting the Quakers and some of that tradition as well. But there's other pacifists too who say it's not because we're a world citizen, but because we're called to something very particular. Does the difference sound?
Oh, yeah.
It makes sense? Yeah. One is going to say, I'm not so involved in any group that I can't see the goodness of all. And the other is going to say, I'm so involved in this group that this is what I, as a Christian, am called to do. And others might be called to something else, but I can't imagine it. That's where pacifists really rub butt heads with other kinds of liberalism, theological liberalism, because this is a conservative doctrine. This is saying, you're called to do this. Preserve it. Be the church, by golly.
Really conservative. I mean, just on the verses that you quoted there, it's not a conservative cloistering verse. It's an all-inclusive, treating every man as an equal, thereby making it impossible to attack another man. If you treat a person as an equal, realizing that every person is a child of God, regardless of their national location or anything like that, that's what makes it impossible.
Yeah, right. And so I guess the difference is whether we do that because every person is a child of God, which I think is very much part of the Christian gospel, or whether we do that because it's we've thought of a universal principle that it makes the most sense to treat everyone. These are ethics that get born out of modern liberalism with
couldn't you tie that back to do not be lukewarm? If you are, I will spew thee out.
Right.
You either recognize that every person is a child of God, regardless of nationality, regardless of ethnicity or language or gender or political extrapolation.
Yeah, and so I think I've used this word radical pacifist. You can imagine a kind of militant pacifism, extremist pacifism, right?
Why is it extremist? Just because it's a small group of people that believes that way?
Why
do you use the word extremist?
Yeah, it's a loaded word these days, right? that it's putting this particular narrative above any other general universalizable principles that I think this person should agree to and this person, regardless of their faith. Mm-hmm. It's extremist and radical. It says, I don't know what you all are called to do. I'm a Christian because I hear this calling and I'm a disciple and I'm following this come what may. I think that's a big difference. It's not saying this is true because we see it as being effective or this is the way it ought to be based on other means, but this is true for me.
Okay.
But this is true because Jesus said so.
Yeah, right. Almost fundamentalist in that sense.
In the end.
Right? I mean, yeah.
And Jesus called it to include everybody.
All who hear this word.
I understand that Jesus called everybody to love. Love is universal. Again, across state boundaries and everything. Jesus calls us to love.
Yeah. But I think there is a difference between then thinking about what could be done by everyone, right? Which I think you end up with a watered-down ethic that says, yeah, we have to protect one another. There are circumstances. We don't want everyone being pacifist all the time, right? We count on protection when we think about the
pacifist,
world.
We wouldn't need protection.
Yeah. Ready, set, go, let's do it, but we don't live in this world, right? So the question will be a kind of a realism, whether right, we don't live in a world where everyone loves each other, Does that mean that we can't ask people to be pacifists because it won't work? Or the question is, can you be pacifist because you're called to be pacifist in a world that's not? And martyrdom then becomes an option, right? We might see more people die rather than fewer. Which is another way of saying I don't think pacifist is a tactic to rid the world of violence. It's a path of being in the world that is violent. It's not a strategy, according to this tradition of pacifists. It may work. Civil rights movement, it works sometimes. South Africa can work. But even when it doesn't, even when it leads to crucifixion or worse, it's still a path for living faithfully, of witnessing. Witness would be another positive word we put here. That we're called to a life of witness. Lutherans and others will think about more, we're called to transform. That's sometimes more Calvin language than Luther. But to be effective, right? And to be public in the world, to engage the world. The question is, how much of the world's rules do we need to play by to engage in that way? The pacifists are going to call us back and say, don't give up your identity in engaging the world, right? If you become synonymous with the world, you've lost. You've lost even if you win, right? Dale, I'm back here.
Well, the fathers in a very practical way, the founders of our country said that if there's an imbalance of power, there will be an abuse of power. And so they sought to separate the three branches of government, separate the military from the legislature, separate the church from the government. So should we not be working, as for instance in the nuclear reign, for a balance of power?
My question always would be, who's the we?
All participants.
Who? So this is what I do with my students. So I'm just playing devil's advocate. All participants in what?
Well, the nations who are confronting each other.
I don't care what the nations do. I'm a Christian. I'm mouthing the voice of a pacifist. I don't need to speak for my country. I don't need to say that my Christian ethic is synonymous with what makes the most sense for a nation or the world or the nations. I say, I'm not called.
Are you saying pacifists are totally self-centered?
Well, what does Luther mean by self-centered?
That's a good question. No, okay. Because they have a doctrine of the church and it's a communitarian ethic. They say, this isn't about me, it's about us. It's about sustaining a pattern of life that is the ecclesia, that is the church. And in fact, we couldn't develop the dispositions of peacefulness without training our young to do it. I mean, it's a very much a group. This is why they get accused of being sectarian, is they're very much like, let's gather together and be the kingdom of God. And if you want to invade Iraq, go for it. But we don't do it because we're Christian. It's hard for us to think this way because we so much think of my national identity and my religious identity as being this compatible, right? I can do them both. These folks are saying, really? Is it? Since when? About 312. Right? Again, that was a little loaded. But that's the hard rhetoric that I want to continue to hear. There's another comment back here. Yeah. Sorry.
I just wanted to, in response to the question that was just raised, I wanted to really appreciate some of the earlier things you said about multiple pacifisms.
Yeah, right.
And that there is no way of being pacifist.
Sure.
There are many ways.
Right.
And some would take one stance that it is just what I need to do, and others would say this is my witness in the world that is trying to shape the world that way.
Yeah.
But
right.
I think that's kind of important. But also I wanted to just comment related to the question that came from the balcony, and you were trying to talk about what you meant by radical.
Yeah.
And you were kind of questioning that, and it seems to me that what you were saying in a sense was that it's radical in that it puts the norm of not killing above all other norms.
Right.
And it puts, say, above the norm of protecting the innocent or above the norm of caring
right.
for country.
Right.
And in a sense, that's what I heard you saying.
Yeah, that's a great way to say it.
And the other thing was that we're called to love, but love is interpreted in multiple different ways. So love can be interpreted as killing. Love can be interpreted validly in many different ways. To say we're called to love doesn't give any definition of what we're supposed to do.
The interpretation of love is one thing, but ultimately when you are standing face to face with God, your interpretation will come question. So your interpretation better be straight.
No, no, I'm simply saying that if I say mug, mm-hmm. your neighbor, you would have to think really hard about what that means you're supposed to do.
Correct.
Because, so that's all I was saying.
You two have a dinner date. I know that there was other hands up. All of us have dinner dates now. I want to end by saying two things, three things. One, I'm sorry I talked as much as I did. I hope you hear how awkwardly I'm trying to hear this. I mean, it's not my tradition, but I really want to take it seriously and maybe start to live it, because I think it's a calling that we do well to really hear and respond to. Second thing, just a quick plug on this book. This is a friend of mine who's in an intentional community outside, or in Durham, North Carolina. He and his wife and other folks went with a Christian peacekeeping team into Iraq when the war is being declared with Iraq. It ends up that their car gets bombed, mistaken, or that doesn't really matter if you're on the road at that point, I think, in the early warfare, gets bombed. And some Muslims in the city of Rutba save them. Doctors there take care of them when they're in Iraq, which is, you know, biblical Babylon. Great story, right, to Baghdad and beyond, how I got born again in Babylon. And they started an intentional community in Durham, North Carolina that witnesses to the way of Jesus, this kind of radical peacekeeping and peacemaking way. It's a great story. He's a really young guy, and think of him as prophetic, and want to keep on listening to folks like him.
What's his name?
Sorry, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. His father-in-law is another famous Jonathan Wilson, who writes a lot from a more evangelical perspective. I might have forgotten
the third
thing. That always happens, right?
How awkward. The book and...
Was it the other book?
I can do that, sure. Yeah. It's a good guess, right, sitting right here. John Howard Yoder is a Mennonite author that many of you know. And people like Hauerwas are very controversial, polemical in many ways, turn people off. He has even more of a potty mouth than I do. John Howard Yoder, I think, says things very straight, and it's a different vision than many Lutherans here, but is a good person to read to really hear these different voices. He coins term like Constantinianism, right? It really helps us to think about what happens here and how we might be called to a different way of life. Here's the last thing, I did remember it. I take it as disheartening news that we didn't talk a lot about just war, that most every mainline church in Roman Catholicism declared the war of Iraq, the siege on Iraq, the first one, to be unjust. The just war has certain principles that need to be met. Just war theorists believe war is wrong. They believe Christians are called to nonviolence, but they say sometimes tragically necessary. And they develop very hard criteria that need to be met so that Christians could go to war, or that a Christian nation, whatever that means, could go to war. Like right intention, it has to be declared by a proper authority, all these kinds of things. An end has to be in sight. You have to have an exit plan, all these things. Almost every mainline church declared the Iraq War wrong, and yet it's our kids. I mean, it's the military is personnel and funded by our money, by our kids. There's very little power that I think churches have to say that this is wrong and then do anything about it, besides, you know, going on and doing what we did before. One of the things that we can learn from pacifist churches is to say it's got to be a hard line in the sand. That you can't declare something unjust without the resources and the passions and the dispositions to imagine a different way. If you can't imagine a different way, then you can sign pieces of paper, but it goes on as possible. So part of this is reclaiming some of the power of the church to imagine alternatives as well. Thanks, y'all.